nuclear transmission.
With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Send a clear transmission.
There is only one line of division. Only one. It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews. It's not a line of division between Arabs and Jews. It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all and those who stand for the supremacy of some. And that government stands for the supremacy of some. No more. When I say long live Palestine, you say long live Gaza. Are you with me? Yeah. This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take the tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine! Long live Palestine! Listen to tunes made by ignorant fools. Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and we won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we are quick to consume. And this is not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts. What I spit is the truth. It makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions than you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. And it's not because of rockets. Please God, can you stop this? Ooh, I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words can never ever explain the raw tragedy. This is not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly. And we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if that was your family. This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine!
Long live Palestine!
Long live Palestine!
Long live Palestine!
This is not just a war over stolen land. Why do you think there's little boys throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on little girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. Cause there's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel was a terrorist state, terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it's like systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Peace and love.
I'll begin with January 2006, when there were parliamentary elections in the occupied Palestinian territories, and Hamas, the Islamic movement, won. According to Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, the elections were completely honest and fair. In response to those completely honest and fair elections, Israel and then the U.S. imposed economic sanctions on the people of Palestine, the people of Gaza. In January or June 2007, Israel, the United States, and some elements in the Palestinian Authority, they tried to overthrow the legally elected government in Gaza. Hamas resisted. The Palestinian elements were sent packing to the West Bank, and now Hamas had full control of Gaza. Israel, backed by the United States, that imposed or tightened the economic blockade of Gaza. A blockade that Amnesty International called a flagrant violation of international law. The Goldstone report, it said the blockade was a possible crime against humanity. The former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she journeyed to Gaza during these months, and she said, Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating. Its whole civilization has been destroyed. In June 2008, Hamas and Israel entered into a ceasefire, and each side had obligations under the ceasefire. Hamas was supposed to cease its rocket and mortar attacks on Israel, and Israel was supposed to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza, a blockade which is a flagrant violation of international law, the blockade which was destroying Gaza's civilization. According to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas, and now I'm quoting it, was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel, however, reneged on its obligation to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. Well, what happened next? It's not hard to find. All you have to do is turn to Amnesty International's yearbook for 2008. And this is what they write. A ceasefire agreed in June between Israel and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza. It held for 4.5 months, but it broke down after Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian militants in airstrikes and other attacks on November 4th. Israel patiently waited until the day of the U.S. elections, the historic elections, when the media and public opinion would be riveted to the result. And on that day, it attacked Gaza and killed 6 Palestinians, knowing full well that would cause a breakdown in the ceasefire. And it did break down. But until the end of December, Hamas kept saying, we're willing to renew the ceasefire. We're willing to renew the ceasefire. But Israel has to implement the original terms of the ceasefire. It has to lift the blockade of Gaza, that flagrant violation of international law, which was destroying the civilization. Israel said no. It said that there had to be unconditional and unilateral Hamas cessation of rocket fire. By December 2008, Sarah Roy of Harvard, the world's leading authority in the Gaza economy, and as it happens, the daughter of survivors of Auschwitz concentration camp, Professor Roy wrote, the breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us, but there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored. And now Hamas had really only 2 stark options. One was to acquiesce in the starvation of the people of Gaza, and the second one was to fight. Hamas opted for resistance, although largely symbolic resistance. The former Israeli commander in Gaza, he said at this time, you cannot just land blows, leave the Palestinians in Gaza in the economic distress they're in, and expect that Hamas will just sit around and do nothing. In the midst of the invasion, Hamas's leader Khaled Mishaal said, our modest homemade rockets are our cry of protest to the world. What were those rockets, if not a message to an indifferent world? SOS, we're dying. SOS, we're dying.
Well, let me begin with two caveats, pitfalls that I think we should be careful to avoid. It's very important to have this meeting about Gaza, one of the most disgraceful situations in the world. But we should remember that it's only in U.S. and Israeli policy that Gaza is separated from the West Bank. They're a unity, one unit, what's left of Palestine, 22% of the original mandate. Now, it's very important for the U.S. and Israel to separate the two and isolate them. For one thing, that means if there ever is some kind of a political settlement, the West Bank will be deprived of any access to the outside world. It will be imprisoned. It won't have a seaport. It'll essentially be contained by two enemies. So there is a strategic reason for the long-standing and intense effort to distinguish Gaza and the West Bank, to keep them apart, to ban transport, and also kind of ideologically to make them seem as if they're two different places. They aren't, outside of U.S.-Israeli ideology. And we should be careful not to to resist that, I think. Another division that I think it's important to resist is between U.S. and Israel. Now, we constantly talk, rightly, about Israeli crimes, but that's highly misleading because they are U.S.-Israeli crimes. There's nothing that Israel does that goes beyond what the United States authorizes and, in fact, directly supports with economic, diplomatic, military, and also ideological support, that is, by framing issues. So these are U.S.-Israeli crimes, so we should remember we're talking about ourselves.
For the first time in 47 years of my life, I was able, through going with the Free Gaza Movement on these two wooden, cracked, rusted, and very, very old boats, to go to Palestine without being humiliated, without being forced to have a permission, without being taken to a room interrogated, without being shouted at, without being told off. And all what I want to do is to go and visit my birthplace. That's how it felt. And I said to myself, and I said it to the press many times, I really wish this for every single Palestinian man, woman, and child. I wish it for you, Munib, here, for you, Assam, for all the Palestinians that I know and their families. It's such a simple thing, and we are not even allowed it. Not even allowed it. And that's the personal side behind me participating, because last year, on the 11th of July, my mom was taken to hospital, and we were told she suffered internal bleeding. She was 85 years old, and for 9 long days she was dying, and I couldn't reach her. And this is the justice of that Israel, the only so-called democracy in the Middle East, is imposing the Palestinians. I took part with 44 very brave men and women, including Hedy here, and everybody who didn't go with us, including people in the land team, including people who supported us from Europe, from America. They were part of this, and they were great part of it, and they were as if they were with us. And definitely Hedy was with us in every single conversation we had in Gaza, because all of them were real committed people, regardless of the fact that they went with us on the boat or not. 44 volunteers, very modest, very humble people, who have one thing in mind, and that's to take on the cause of justice for the Palestinians, to take on the Israeli military might, to challenge the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation. And we held our position, we stood our ground, and we did, symbolically and practically, we did take on the Israeli military might. They tried everything, as Hedy said. And Hedy talked about nonviolent. We all of us, all through our preparation, we kept saying we are nonviolent.
Let me tell you this. I used to be the head of the Foreign Office Maritime Section. What Israel did in boarding a foreign ship in international waters is an act of illegal war, plain and simple.
Hello, you're listening to the third podcast brought to you from Sheffield Indie Radio. I'm 2% Human, one of your hosts on this podcast, and we're currently listening to a mix by ZKT of music from musicfulfreedom.com, which is a website where you can download Palestinian music. And this is Lena Shemamian, or Khamamian. Not sure how you pronounce the name. And these tunes can be, as I said, downloaded from www.songs4freedom.com. Songsforfreedom.com. Part of the podcast is dedicated to all those who struggle in solidarity with the Palestinian people against the war crimes, violations of human rights, illegal blockades, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and murder carried out by the Israeli government. Okay, in that mix we heard first off from Loki spitting at the demo called in early June after the flotilla atrocity. Then we heard from Norman Finkelstein speaking after the Gaza war 2 years ago in January, giving us the history of the blockade. Noam Chomsky speaking about how we've got to remember that Palestine is a single entity. It's not the West Bank and Gaza, it's Palestine. And then we heard from Mashir, the chairman of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Sheffield, speaking about the first Free Gaza flotilla, which managed to break through the blockade and land in Gaza, not without some trouble on the way. And the last speaker there was Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, speaking at the same demo in London.
We can be the mediator.
We're, as I said, the Sheffield Indie Radio Collective, and we're doing this because, well, you know, be the media.
Be the media.
So we have the means of production, we own them, and we're producing.
All right, mate. I'm an old boy, and we've got Chris.
Chris? Who's knackered because he's been working hard.
To give you a bit of an idea of the kind of things you're going to be hearing if we can get the podcast to be a regular thing, we'll be doing stuff from the news internationally, nationally and locally, mixed with music, and a very special section called Bollocks Chat, which comes towards the end of the
show. I'm really looking forward to that.
It's worth it. And so there'll be regular features in the show, for instance, when we cross the invisible line towards the end of the show, there'll be a mix of whatever kind of music I can come up with at the end of the show as well, listings, all sorts of stuff really, and our favourite, Bollocks Chat.
Bollocks Chat.
Coming up today then, in a minute we're going to have a chat with Bob from Alt Sheffield. He's going to be telling us the listings for Sheffield and surrounding area for the next month or thereabouts. We're going to have a bit of audio about the upcoming Bike Fest, chat with the people who are organising that, what we're going to be able to do, that kind of thing. I'll put this in anyway. We'll have a section on the new and up-and-coming Sheffield Social Centre, and then we'll be having we'll be crossing, should I say, the invisible line, which inevitably leads us, I think, to our favourite section, the Bollocks Chat, which technically I think is designed to be alternative analysis of world events.
Deep politics.
Parapolitics. Yeah. The fringes of our good cultural environment.
Created reality.
And then following that, there's a sort of slightly explicit dubstep mix for the outro. So that's what we'll be doing for this podcast.
Let's get on with it.
Let's do it.
Okay, this is Old Boy for Sheffield Indie Radio. We're going to be doing what I think might be a regular feature on the podcast. I've got Bob here from Alt Sheffield Collective. And Bob, I wonder if you could just tell us to start off with what is Alt Sheffield?
Alt Sheffield is a website for Sheffield events, organisations, interesting news. It's sort of meant to go alongside Sheffield Indie Media, so if you want to know what's happening in the next few days in some detail, hope you'll look at it. And if you think of a Sheffield organisation, it's almost certainly listed on there. When I say organisation, it covers anything that's radical, green, socialist, anarchist, feminist.
Pretty much anything you'd be wanting to know about
anything
what's going on in Sheffield.
Ends with this. Definitely.
That ends with this. Bob, just tell us how long has Alt Sheffield been up and running?
Getting on for a couple of years now. It's a small group of us who do it. Hard work, but it's usually interesting. It's usually about 2 weeks in advance, so we just sort of keep on top. We're on a lot of mailing lists and try and spot things coming up that we people will want to know about.
Lovely. Thank you. I wonder then if you could just give us a bit of a rundown of what we're likely to be seeing and or doing in Sheffield over the next month or thereabouts.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, we've got all the regular meetings, but it's festival season, so I'm going to concentrate a little bit more on tell you what the festivals are.
That's a good idea.
Of course, by the time you're listening to this, you've probably missed Peace in the Park. If you weren't there, sad. To be on next
we'll
year.
Try and get the edit Sheffield done, but I doubt it.
We've got, when I say all the usual meetings, the ones I generally mean by that would be the socialist meetings, Animal Friends, Palestine Solidarity, Sheffield Humanists, Women in Black, Greenpeace. There's a long list of them. I'm not going to go through it all, but it's on the website.
Yeah.
Skeptics in the Pub is an interesting group that talks about or debunks myths. And their talk this week is the psychology of anomalous experience. What they mean by that is weird things happen, people think they're mystical, and they're not always.
Sounds interesting.
Meeting on Cuba, women and internationalism, the Cuba Solidarity Campaign's pretty active in Sheffield. And then there's a conference, middle of June, Northern Social Forum. Another world is possible. It's not in Sheffield, it's at Barnsley, but it's not far away.
Oh.
People are interested. I think there might still be places available.
And in terms of times and dates and venues?
I'm not going to go through that because there's a lot of stuff happening. So it's all on www.altchef, that's ALT-chef, SHEFF.co.uk.
Thank you. Please, carry on.
That was a plug, wasn't it?
That was a good one.
Okay, Friday Night Ride. Now, this is a brilliant thing that's been going on for a couple of years in Sheffield. Somebody works really hard to get a theme for a bike ride. And the one on the 18th of June is on the theme of Ruskin in Sheffield. For those who don't know, Ruskin was an early socialist, I suppose, and a social reformer. And he was around here a lot. So the bike ride will be to places with the background information on where he lived and visited. And bikes, Sheffield Bike Festival. That's going to be brilliant, hopefully. It'll be the first one for Sheffield, 19th of June. It's preceded by the World Naked Bike Ride. If you don't know what that is, look on the website. All the links are there.
To see it all there.
It will be, well, yes.
Quite literally all.
Exactly. So there's quite a few bike things over that weekend. Even in Rotherham, there's a bike event. And that is followed by the World Development Movement Activist Gathering. This is a national event, and for the first time, I think, it's been held in Sheffield in June this year. The World Development Movement is one of the better NGOs, non-governmental organisations, so that should be interesting if people are interested in those kind of issues about development. Queer Tango is taking a break for the summer. Queer Tango is a kind of tango lesson which is not gender specific. It's a bit hard to explain, but I'm sure it's a good dance.
Why don't you all have a look?
Yep. So there's vivisection activities, or anti-vivisection activities, continuing. Back to the festivals. We've got Healy Festival on the 19th of June and the Green Fair on the 26th of June. That's a pretty good big festival that's well worth a visit if you've not been before. That's the Green Party's main fundraising thing.
For Sheffield.
For Sheffield, no. It's pretty good fun. There's all beer, they have music. Right, towards the back end of June, there's something, a meeting about Sheffield Social Centre. To me, this is a really exciting development in Sheffield. A social centre is a space, a building, set up in a non-hierarchical way, and it's supposed to be a space within capitalism as an anti-capitalist space. Now, obviously, a social centre, like any kind of community centre, is there for people to use, so it can be an open door to all sorts of other activities, and hopefully it will be the key to other things which otherwise bring people together, in other words. I've been to other social centres, they're usually great, there's usually all sorts of meetings, gigs, lessons, courses happening there. Usually, social centres are squatted and they don't last long. Now, the plan is to go for something permanent, and this group is working hard towards that, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens.
Good.
It will take a year or two before we get to that point.
Yeah. People might remember other squatted social centres in Sheffield over the years that probably quite a lot of us have been around and been involved with, but as you say, they tend to be temporary autonomous zones, don't they?
That's the word, temporary autonomous zones.
Slightly more permanent autonomous space. So that is a really good development for to Sheffield and activists in Sheffield.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll lose any of the excitement if you turn it into an organisation. I think that knowing that you're building something permanent for the future, to me, that matters. It doesn't stop other activities which are perhaps more temporary.
Yeah.
For example, in July, there's going to be something called a free school. It'll be over a weekend in July, and as usual, watch this space.
Right.
It will be on the Alt Chef website,
right. And
it'll be on the website for the Sheffield Social Centre. So, yeah, towards the end of the month, with Sheffield Pride Festival, what's that, LGBT?
Yeah.
Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Transgender Festival. That's usually a really good event. Loads of music, loads of happy people. Sheffield also got Firth Park Festival. That's more of a community festival, but for those of you who know,
yeah,
Firth Park is it's a big park, it's a big festival.
Yeah.
Usually a good laugh. This is perhaps worth mentioning, something that's not so high profile, a group called the Pixies, having a Skillshare workshop at Art in the Park on 30th of June, Clifton Park in Rotherham. Now, the Pixies are interested in guerrilla gardening, the Earth Centre at Conisbrough, and all sorts of reclaiming the earth kind of activities.
Sounds good.
And Sharrow Festival on the other side of town. South Yorkshire Festival at Wortley Hall, near Barnsley.
Yeah.
Wortley, that's the one.
Mm.
And then going into July, there's Woodseats Festival. So it's going to be really exciting. And then the final event to mention in particular is the Skeptics in the Pub. They have their next meeting mid-month, and they're going to talk about suggestion, suggestibility and hypnosis. I think this is kind of how people can be persuaded that something's happening. They've got in particular something called the ideomotor effect. If you don't know what that is,
often seen in dowsing, isn't it, the idea that people don't think they're moving anything,
yeah,
but actually they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Pendulums and the like.
And that's the one. As
sounds
usual, they'll be debunking the myths and bringing some science and reality to you.
Lovely. Bob, thank you very much.
Okay.
Hopefully we'll be chatting to you again next month.
Okay, lovely.
Cheers.
I hope it's been helpful. I've just flown through a load of stuff, and it's all on www.altshef.co.uk.
Cheers, Bob.
Thank you.
Evolution? Where?
Here, mate.
I'll soon put a stop to that. Evolution? Where?
Here, mate.
Well, on a brighter note, commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Television news is like going to Disneyland. You know you're really there, and you know it's not real.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV.
The Sheffield Bike Festival, when is it and what's happening?
So on Saturday the 19th of June on Devonshire Green in Sheffield, there's going to be all sorts of things, all sorts of activities for lots of different people. There's going to be a bike-powered stage, live bands during the day. We're going to have cycle speedway for people to have a go at, so people are racing bikes on carpet. We're going to have a load of novelty bikes for people to try out, some disability bikes for people to try out, a bike polo competition, a decorating your own bike competition with the possibility of winning a bike. We're going to have a bike ballet display, we're going to have trials displays,
BMX workshops,
unicycle riding workshops,
bike ballet, say bike ballet.
Yeah. arts and crafts activities, food stalls, various different people coming with stalls to show what's going on in the cycling community in Sheffield. There's going to be a free fix your own... No, there's not. There's going to be free bike safety checks and opportunities for people who can't cycle to learn to cycle on the day as well.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And is there a website where people can find out more information?
Yes, it is www.sheffieldbikefestival.org.uk.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Sheffield Indie Radio. We own the means of production.
The following edit is from a discussion at the Sheffield Anarchist Book Fair on the Sheffield Social Centre. And for more information, go to sheffieldsocialcentre.org.uk.
The idea of a social centre is that it's an autonomous space where it's a self-organised space. So it's a physical building where people can get together, meet collectively, organise activities, plan things together, agitate, inspire, create, and just hang out and socialise. So the idea is that people get together for collective endeavours, which obviously isn't a new idea, and people have been doing it in different ways, whether it's community gardens, provision of cheap food, people getting together for film showings, organising outside of the mainstream. Some of the social centres that are going today have been going for quite a long time, like the 1 in 12 social centre in Bradford is that opened in 1981, and that's still going strong today. Other social centres last for shorter periods of time. Some are squatted, some are bought, some are rented. The politics of social centres will vary. They tend to be like organised on non-hierarchical lines, with the emphasis on self-organisation, supporting different radical groups that might be anti-capitalist, anarchist, tend to be libertarian kind of projects and activities that go on. And within the social centre, there's scope for lots of different things to happen. So a lot of social centres will have a cafe, will have a library, an info shop, meeting space, a place for gigs, a place for parties. There'll be, for longer running ones, there can be ongoing things like lots of social centres run English lessons for non-English speakers, bike workshops, kids' activities, art spaces in different kinds of forms. Above all, they are, you know, basis for the social spaces to offer some kind of refuge and alternative to mainstream capitalist relations. Social centres can be both a means to an end, providing resources for political projects and social projects to go from that space, and also an end in itself, so an experiment in collective living and collective organisation, and a way of learning about the challenges that that brings. So a little glimpse of an alternative that could be out there. There's been a growth in social centres in the UK and Ireland over probably the last decade, a lot associated with the anti-capitalist movement. Indeed, there was in Sheffield a long-running spotted social centre, which was called Matilda's, which lasted from 2005 to 2006, which began as a convergence space for protests against the G8. And then since then, there's been a number of short-lived squats, as indeed there was before, and there were other social centres before Matilda's as well. But mostly, they have been fairly short-lived, and then a collective came together last year that was kind of hoping for something a bit more than that.
Yeah, well, we kind of decided that we wanted to squat a place. That was kind of what we were... You know, initially, at least, possibly leading to something more long term. But as a kind of experiment to see how we kind of how it worked out, we thought we'd squat a place, and it October last year, we set up a squatted social centre in the Piscar House. Yeah, a number of kind of issues came up with the whole squatting thing. I think particularly when we got kicked out the first time and we moved into the second one, a lot of kind of momentum was lost and a lot of people sort of got burnt out, a little bit disillusioned, and, you know, scared by the fines as well. There was only kind of a core group of people who were left doing it and sort of holding the building. And that just got really, really tiring really quickly, because you can't just put a key in the door and leave at the end of the day, you know. So when we were eventually kicked out of that one, we kind of felt, well, you know, that's what we want to be able to do, really, kind of just have our own space that we're not going to get evicted from in like a week, and just be able to lock up at the end of the day. And
over the last few years, there's been kind of quite a lot of debate in the movement with regard to the pros and cons of squatted social centres and rented or bought social centres. And my personal take on it is that I think it's a mistake to see it as an either-or situation. We actually need to do both. So in terms of squatted ones, I think squatted ones can work, like the one last weekend, the Temporary Autonomous Arts one, down on Savile Street, that was just for kind of 4 days. And there's lots of advantages of doing squatted ones, that you don't have to worry about health and safety, you don't have to worry about complying with an awful lot of laws that are kind of really expensive to comply with, and you can just kind of do stuff a lot free. You have a lot more freedom to do stuff that you can't do if you're doing it all legally. But our experience shows that in Sheffield, at least, that kind of only works for short-term things. And I think it'd be really good to have a long-term space as well that is secure and we aren't going to get chucked out of any time, and so that we can put in other bits of kind of infrastructure there. But it also has disadvantages. You know, you have to comply with the law, there's all the health and safety stuff, and it ends up, I mean, if you end up kind of doing a cafe or a bar in order to fund it, and if it's all done with voluntary work, it ends up being an awful lot of work for people. There are disadvantages with having a legal one, and there's advantages, but I think it's wrong to see it as an either or. I think, you know, ideally we should be doing both.
I mean, those are the issues that come up about, you know, the difficulties of trying to be alternative within the system. You know, it's like you can only be so far. It's like if you are going to engage in property relations at all, then there will be compromises along the way. And, you know, and every collective will have to discuss what level of compromises they want to make.
I think in some respects, though, I think there's an element of compromise, because if you could have a long-lasting and like well-established social centre being financed, as it were, by a cafe of some kind, that wasn't profiteering, that was just simply allowing the social centre to keep running, if you balance the kind of ideological conflict with the amount of good that social centre could do, I think you have to assess whether, like, putting aside some elements of ideology and kind of working towards a longer end goal, what doing more good over a longer period of time rather than taking an ideological stand immediately, whether that creates a better sort of end result than otherwise not.
The decision has been made to definitely pursue the idea of buying a building.
Yeah.
And as has been said, along the way to do other shorter term projects as well. So there are kind of like a number of different things that are being moved forward. So in terms of like what will be happening at the meeting on Monday, it will be looking at the progress of the long-term goal, but also some shorter-term projects that are going to be happening over the next few months. So like one of the ideas is, you know, is to do a weekend free school, and then, you know, other kind of like...
In terms of like getting involved with a group, you know, we don't just sit around discussing all the time. We do have fun as well. We get together for socials and things, and we're intending to do that more kind of often. So, you know, the people involved are really nice, you know, nice group of people. So, get involved.
There's a website, which is probably the best way to be in touch. If you can't come to the meeting, then meetings are put up on the website, and there's an email address there for contact, which is just info@socialcentre.org.
Right, we're just heading into the second half of the podcast, and we're just about to go into the section where we're hoping to be a regular feature called Crossing the Invisible Line. And to preface Crossing the Invisible Line, here's a talk given in 1993 by Michael Parenti, which is downloadable from TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness Radio. So Google that and Michael Parenti, Michael Parenti.
The title of the talk is Conspiracy and Class Power, and the key word in that title is the and. That is, what you're getting on the left lately is a debate in which people are saying, we mustn't look at conspiracy, we've got to look at the broader institutional system. And I think it's an incorrect argument that it's not conspiracy or class power, it's conspiracy and class power. And I'm not going to talk about any specific conspiracies in any detail. I want to talk about the relationship of conspiracy to the larger political economic context of the system. And I think it can be approached in three basic ways. First, you can look at the system as a conservative celebration. How wonderful our free market society is, and how much more wonderful it would be if it were not for meddlesome government regulations and the demands of undeserving low-income groups that feed out of the public trough. That's the conservative celebration. The second approach is a liberal complaint about how some of our priorities are all wrong, how there are serious problems that represent aberrant departures from what is otherwise a basically good system. And then the third approach you might call a radical analysis. And that sees ecological crises and military interventions and the national security state and homelessness and poverty and undemocratic social institutions such as the corporate-owned media. It sees these things not as aberrant outcomes of a basically rational system, but as rational outcomes of a system whose central goal is the accumulation of wealth and power for a privileged class. Tell Ullman is right that these things must all be looked at dialectically, that is, they must be looked at as part of a context of power and interest that is systemic. But what I'm talking about today is not class, but class power, the class power system, which is something more and something else. If you take that third perspective of a radical analysis, if you move from a conservative celebration or a liberal complaint to a radical analysis, you cross an invisible line and you will be labeled in mainstream circles as a conspiracy theorist.
You're right, and it's a conspiracy.
Yeah, well, it's conspiracy theory.
Yeah, inside job, yeah. Controlled demolitions, yeah. Yeah, yeah, the truth, yeah. Wake up.
And here's Gore Vidal crossing the Hoover Institute's invisible line by suggesting that American imperial power is in Afghanistan because of oil.
Nobody will get into the subject of what we're doing in Afghanistan. Now, why would we bother with Afghanistan? The greatest supply of oil and natural gas on Earth is in the old Russian republics. We have 60,000 troops in these various republics. We've used the Afghanistan adventure to get in there. We're after that oil and after that natural gas.
To use a phrase used by one of your friends when he hears something that sounds a little bit far-fetched, that sounds a little grassy knolly to me.
The people who most dislike conspiracy theories are conspirators.
Oh, let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
I know that you don't think that there's ever a real reason for things other than just the desire to put the flag somewhere or spread our religion or our way of life. This is a reality. Look, everybody running the government is in the oil and gas business.
I mean, the whole COINTEL thing was a federal FBI conspiracy.
Yeah.
And of course, the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. Those are suspected state crimes against democracy, but they get labeled as conspiracy theories. And it's kind of an effective method of preventing ongoing investigations from being reported in the media and kept out of a broader public scrutiny. That's pretty deliberate. So these things get labeled that way, and the people that are implementing them, they know that the people are far less willing to examine information that disputes rather than confirms their beliefs.
We're now going to cross the invisible line and perhaps discuss some of those things.
Yeah, let's cross the invisible line.
Get the tinfoil hats on. We're going to cross the invisible line any minute now.
You're on. Are you ready to cross the invisible line? Yes? Here we go.
Okay, on today's Crossing the Invisible Line, we'll be featuring Dr. Shyam Sunder of NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the United States. He was in charge of the investigation of the World Trade Center demolitions, or collapses, depending on your point of view. Let's hear what Dr. Sunder has to say.
If it's moving down in a dynamic fashion, the magnitude of the energy unleashed is so large that no structure can withstand that kind of force that is applied. And it essentially came down in free fall.
A free fall time would be an object that has no structural components below it.
If it's moving down in a dynamic fashion, the magnitude of the energy unleashed is so large that no structure can withstand that kind of force that is applied. And it essentially came down in free fall.
A free fall time would be an object that has no structural components below it.
If it's moving down in a dynamic fashion, the magnitude of the energy unleashed is so large that no structure can withstand that kind of force that is applied. And it essentially came down in free fall.
A free fall time would be an object that has no structural components below it.
But Dr. Sunder holds a Bachelor of Technology honours degree in civil engineering, a Master of Science degree in civil engineering from MIT, and a Doctor of Science degree in structural engineering from MIT.
Well, gravity is the loading function that applies to the structure, applies to every body, all bodies on this particular on this planet, not just in ground zero.
Okay, foot soldier of the ruling class, Dr. Shyam Sunder there, suffering the consequences of cognitive dissonance as a consequence of holding two contradictory ideas in his mind at the same time. And now we're going to move into Bollocks Chat, and just to start that off, here's a note from Noam Chomsky.
A bitter class war. It should be understood to be a real war, and it's not a new war, it's an old war. Furthermore, it's a perfectly conscious war everywhere, but specifically in the United States, where there happens to have a highly class-conscious business class, and always has, and they have long seen themselves as fighting a bitter class war, except they don't want anybody else to know about it.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
Right, welcome to Bollocks Chat. I've got old boy and Chris here with me, and we're going to chat bollocks. So, what were you suggesting that we should talk bollocks about next?
About the Biden rule is a... Is
the Biden rule's an interesting
tactic,
one, isn't it? Yeah, isn't it? Because I'll span everything from you know, the Right to Move Street Fighting crew, the EDL, to surveillance
and its corresponding new front arch rival, the...
What are they called again?
Muslims Against Crusades.
Muslims
Al-Majahroon's latest front organisation.
Heavily subsidised by me and Ian, very probably.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
And in Birmingham, I've not looked at the stuff on this yet, but I've just come across it. They're putting in loads of, for the Muslim, one of the Muslim areas of Birmingham, they're putting in loads of hidden surveillance cameras and doing automatic number plate recognition. And if they're doing that, I wouldn't be surprised if they're also doing, I'd be surprised if they weren't also doing stuff with mobile phones and sort of tracking
uh-huh.
you know, where people are and
physically
who's close to each other, but also who's communicating with each other in terms of
so if Google could drive down your street doing Street View and nick all this data coming out of people's Wi-Fi devices, they'd be doing that as well, wouldn't they? If Google can do
they might well be doing that. Well, and monitoring everyone's phone and internet connections and what everyone's doing. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a kind of they see it as a dry run for something they can roll out elsewhere.
Right, sort of electronic ghettoisation.
Yeah. And clearly, I think with the kind of threat of looming antagonism between the poor and the rich,
uh-huh.
I think they would much rather have race riots going on and people being distracted and fighting amongst each other instead uh-huh. of focusing on people
so,
the real
so do you think we should be focusing on non-violent direct action?
I think 99% of the time.
Do you think that the state would want us to be violent so that they can be violent themselves and be more repressive?
You're talking about Asian provocateurs. Sure, I mean they exist and it happens, and it happens in lots of ways. It happens online, it happens virtually, and it happens physically. Protests. I mean, look at the way that the stuff at the Royal Bank of Scotland was set up in London as a kind of media
kettle.
Stunt.
Yeah, and they kettled the.
Yeah, and they pinned everyone against the only bank that wasn't boarded up.
Yeah. And had all the media there waiting.
Yeah, and then the story had been written already. It was one of the story of violent anarchists attack bank.
Yeah.
And it was all.
So,
the coverage of the kind of smashing up of the camp, in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
It wasn't, that just wasn't covered. And then all the cover ups with the murder of Ian Tomlinson.
Yeah.
And talking of cover ups, what about the Bloody Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah. 32 year cover up.
Yeah.
With a Widgery report thrown in. All innocent.
As we knew already.
Mm.
And where's the action going to be taken against all the people that have been involved actively conspiring to cover this up for all these decades?
Perjury and lies and all the rest of it.
But they're all old now, so that absents you from any.
Well, that's another tactic, isn't it? Is to make things. Not go away as such, but just keep them simmering until everybody's long gone.
Pinochet,
JFK, just the length of time it takes to have an inquiry.
I guess that'll come out at some point, won't it?
What?
JFK.
Will come out of where?
The fact that, I'm sure there was US intelligence agency involvement in that.
Yeah, well, Lee Harvey Oswald couldn't shoot. That's in his military record. And the gun he had was tested by firearms specialists, and it wasn't set up properly. And he had one shot from hundreds of yards away, and he got his man. Quite remarkable. Gun couldn't shoot straight, and yet he somehow...
The Michael Parenti audio on TUCradio.org's archive about Michael Parenti talking about Chomsky and JFK is really good.
Yes.
And the way that Chomsky just wouldn't look at the evidence, and it's got parallels with other events.
More recent events. So it's these big events as well. They're a means of control, psychological control. I think
fear. It's fear. About fear, controlling people with fear, isn't it? Fear of this, you know, fabricated, exaggerated, manufactured, stoked up, created.
Well, even simple crime stories on, you know, local radio, you turn the local radio on and say, oh, Mrs. Blah Blah was murdered. And just giving you this impression that don't go out, it's dangerous out there, be very afraid. Messaging on all the media, newspapers, radio, TV. There's always a daily murder. I mean, I think somebody calls it mortality. It's kind of mortality awareness. You remind the public every day that they're going to die one day. And that kind of calms you down a bit as well. And it's all part of this full spectrum dominance media onslaught on people's minds.
So unplug the corporate matrix.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
I'm just thinking of do we need to defeat the ruling class, or do we just have to learn to live with him, or what?
I think every generation has some idea that they want to do something about how shit it all is.
Yeah.
And every generation seems to be duped by the same sets of ideas.
Yeah.
Not just peddled by those people, but peddled by, we were talking earlier about trade union leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Trade union leaders' job is to negotiate.
Yeah.
Nothing more, not overthrow, not replace, not, you know. So
not even fundamentally questioned.
No, they're, you know, if capitalism disappears, they've got no job, have they? Because you can't negotiate between workers and workers. It doesn't work that way, does it?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's fairly obvious that. But yeah, I think. Yeah, I think a lot about it all. Yeah, it's so a lot. It hurts your head a bit, doesn't it? When you think about it a lot.
Yeah.
It depends. Different days I think different things, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, some days I read or see some stuff and I think it's all going to be shit.
So, I mean, what's the answer? We know the situation is utterly dire. We're committing planetary ecocide.
Just making that noise we're doing now.
That is the noise of country ecocide.
We know what.
I don't think anybody. I mean, I haven't got all the answers, have I? But
I think most of the answers are there. Actually,
it's not hard, I suppose.
How to organise society in a sustainable, egalitarian, you know, democratic way. I think all the answers are pretty much there. I think we've got all as much technology as we need to do it, and we have had for decades.
Mm.
The only thing we can't seem to be able to work out is how to get from here to there.
Uh-huh. Well, I think the first step on that is to challenge the ruling class, because I see the ruling class as the main barrier to social evolution, because they're in a position of power and wealth and privilege, and they want to keep it that way, and that's what you might call natural.
Yeah. Somebody said to me, actually, up in Scotland on the G8 demo, but don't we need helicopter gunships to do that? And actually, in response to your questions and thoughts earlier on,
yeah,
I kind of think ultimately we do need helicopter gunships to do that kind of thing.
Right.
Maybe being flown by the people who normally fly helicopter gunships.
Yeah.
But on our side.
But if you think that the ruling class are a very small number, and that if that situation where a situation arose where the people in helicopter gunships decided, yeah, we're with the people, you know, we're not going to throw in our lot with the ruling class, then they wouldn't need to fire a shot, would they? Because there would be a very few people.
That would be a unified response. My understanding of that kind of social upheaval tends not to be, I mean, there have been occasions, but tends to be that there is some bitter battle, isn't there? And And as to what it all, I think we have got all the technology, and there's certainly lots of ideas about what life should be about. But I think we also have to remember the journey of getting there. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? That isn't going to be overly pleasant. It's not going to be a...
So there's no negotiated
peace. It's not a Woodcraft folk day out. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
That would be my thought about it. If we're talking about street demonstrations, then, you know, you have to make decisions about how important it is and what you're doing and what your goals and objectives are as to whether you use tactics that are more provocative or less provocative. But, you know, there are times at which, crucial points at which...
Well, like the Gaza flotilla, that was...
That was a crucial point for the Israeli state, yeah, for sure. And it's completely understandable from their point of view.
So it's a direct action, but it was a peaceful action.
I see what you mean. I'm not opposed to peaceful action.
Yeah.
I don't dispute that, but I think
see, the key to the
peace of violence is a tactical issue,
yeah,
not a moral position or a, for me, I'm not saying for everybody,
yeah,
but for me, whether or not you use violence is very much dependent on.
But if you're up against the Sixth Fleet and you're on your own and you've got,
yeah,
thrust,
I ain't going to be pulling my popcorn out, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So it seems the odds are stacked.
But it's a tactical issue.
Yeah,
it's a tactical issue.
Although, having said that, the Sixth Fleet ceases to function as soon as there's no more oil. There is that consideration.
For me, and I'm not saying for everyone, but violence is a tactic, not a moral fetishist position.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It very much depends on where you are and what you're doing as to whether violence is an appropriate... And I mean, widest range of violence, including violence against property, which people seem to think is so terrible. And yet,
so, for example, in a in order to get the people, the ruling class, to get enough people in helicopter gunships to fight against the guys who've turned to our side in helicopter gunships,
yeah,
then...
Can I just say this is not a necessarily thought out position? Because I don't think there is a blueprint for it. I don't think it's a blueprint issue. It's not like...
Well, I think there are certain ways you can... because what I'm trying to get across is the structure of power, which is hierarchy, which is authority, which is information up, orders down. And what I think is that you can disrupt that hierarchy with information, because it depends on information. It's why they spend so much money on intelligence gathering, you know, and there are so many intelligence gathering networks, and it's about information, and they control information, and the rest of us don't have any participation in what goes as official information. So I think there are ways of disrupting that power structure. I think there are, you know, and it's say how you would, how helicopter gunship pilots would realise that, yeah, I'm better off, you know, with the rest of my species rather than this few thousand billion trillionaires who have promised me the world, and that, you know, or whatever, you know, you can have whatever you want. Here's $1 trillion if you fly your aeroplane and go and do that. So I'm trying to, yeah.
I was saying, I'm thinking in the long run, we'd hopefully not have any helicopter gunships, because
yes,
hopefully no one would be prepared to build them.
Yeah, even that, even to that kind of level, where it's where information disrupts the hierarchy, so orders aren't carried out, or you know, but it is dependent on being able to get information into the hierarchy. That, and I always quote Craig Murray, you know, as somebody being in the hierarchy, having a decent life, being in the hierarchy of being an operative for the ruling class in Africa initially, and then he moved to Uzbekistan, where he kind of got a kind of revelation about the truth of empire, where he, you know, people were getting boiled alive for just information about the numbers of Al-Qaeda, so that the people back at the Pentagon could say, yeah, we need more defence spending, the numbers of Al-Qaeda are increasing, you know, we've got these intelligence reports. And Craig Murray blew the whistle on that intelligence gathering and kind of turned and left the hierarchy, and is now campaigning for human rights, or, you know, and doing his utmost to to promote those kind of human values rather than. So it's that finding out of information like that, you know, has kind of put a spanner in the works of the hierarchy. And that's the kind of. And that was information, really. He gathered the information himself, but, you know, the effect it had on him. Although the effect it had on the rest of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is not too disruptive, you know.
That's the problem, isn't it? You know, it's. You know, is the next revolution going to be an information revolution? Or is it going to be.
Well, that's what
old school,
for, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose that's debatable, isn't it? Is it going to be old school bare knuckle fighting class war, or is it going to be, you know, individuals changing their ideas?
And not participating.
Power and not participating.
Yeah, just making that a choice not to, to carry on participating.
If your attrition rate is, one every 6 months, one every year, one every 5 years.
Yeah, and then they're easily
replaced. It's not
really
hard to replace, is it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or kill. If you need to.
We haven't got long the way things are going with the energy,
I'm
climate.
Old school. Bare knuckle fighting class war.
I'm not going to stop you.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
Yeah, sorry, what were you saying, Chris?
Yeah, well, I mean, we haven't got long, you know, things.
Well,
have
I'm thinking, like, in the next decade, an event like the Gaza Flotilla thing, and or somebody said it in that meeting last night. There was, as soon as kids got shot in Soweto, then it was the end of the apartheid regime, kind of thing. And I'm thinking, you know, and that's just information. That's just the spread of information. You know, that became global and that changed something.
What do you think? It's really fragile, then?
I think it's definitely fragile because of its dependence on information, and they know it depends on the control of information, because the amounts of money they spend on it, it's crucial.
So you're advocating like a Running Man hypothesis.
What's a Running Man hypothesis?
You know the film Running Man?
I've heard the name.
It's a sort of one of those bizarre group of Schwarzenegger anti-capitalist films from the 80s.
Oh, right, that's it.
In which capitalism plays the ultimate game by giving people an opportunity to save prisoners, an opportunity to save their lives by competing to the death with all the prisoners. Gladiator, essentially. And if you win, you go free. And then there's a rebel band of info warriors who plug into the Skynet stroke, you know, the whole same sort of thing as Skynet, I suppose. And by uploading images, the whole world is so shocked by the whole event that the edifice comes crumbling down.
Well, anyway, that does work, because if you look at Vietnam,
it works in the 80s anti-capitalist movies, but.
Well, no, I agree with you that, you know, you go to the movies and it's always, you know, the rebels always win in the movies, and then you walk out to the street and it's the ruling class is still winning.
Yeah.
And in fact, they've taken your money.
Yeah.
You know, while you sat there going, yeah, come on, rebels! Yeah!
See, Avatar.
Yeah, Avatar is typical of that genre, and, you know, male leader, strong leader that leads the troops into action, and no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about things like how media used to be done, which was pictures of kids running out of villages with being napalmed on, you know, primetime television, bringing home you know, that kind of you know, the horror of war and what that did to the anti-war movement in
what did it do to America? Well, that, ultimately, that gave us Jimmy Carter, the Rainbow Coalition, and Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, but it ended. It ended nominally war for a while.
Well, I'm sure you don't necessarily believe that to be true in terms of covert wars in Africa.
I'm talking specifically about an image.
Sure, I don't dispute that, but
there wasn't popular support for a large number of US military overseas deaths.
No, there wasn't.
After Vietnam and until September the 11th. And that changed.
But the ability of the ruling class to be flexible enough to encompass
during that time there was endless wars going on around the world that they were sponsoring, and coups and all this stuff.
But, you know, don't let us forget, you know, that in our own history in Britain, you know, we've had a period of time where leaders of the TEC have sounded like revolutionaries.
Yeah.
In reality, to co-opt and organise, to co-opt the sort of anger of organised workers.
Yeah, controlling dissent. Certainly, sure. Yeah. But that's again, it was so, authoritarian, you know, and hierarchical, sure, system, wasn't it, sure, that did that.
Sure.
And that's the kind of error. It's almost like trying to build a pyramid to fight the ruling class pyramid, to build a hierarchy that's as strong, and then you have this dialectical smash of the Titans and you end up with a paradise or something. But I don't. I think it's much easier just to disrupt that one pyramid that exists, the ruling class hierarchy, the structure, and you disrupt that, and you eat it up from, it's, you know, bottom up. It's what bottom up means to me, is that you eat away at its authority and structure from the bottom up. You know, the idea that that image stopped a war, kind of thing. But that's all it was intended to do. It was only to stop the war. That some people may have thought the anti-Vietnam War was a struggle, a class struggle. But most people involved were involved in an anti-war struggle, and they didn't kind of link it to, well, is it the industrial military complex that really want this war because they're making so much money out of it? And didn't kind of realise that aspect of it. And that's what I mean. It's like, if you then...
Well, when they did start linking it, like Malcolm Luther King was starting to, they just got bumped off.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole string of internal assassinations.
Yeah.
That were conducted, especially against Black Panthers and Black Panthers.
Yeah.
They were fighting quite an intense war on several fronts in the 60s and the 70s.
Yes.
And also, you know, doing all sorts of crazy stuff, like with the Black Panthers. And
I think that
all the COINTELPRO stuff that came out then and is still obviously ongoing.
Yeah, I think that what shows is how basically aware that they are, or that they fear, the ruling class fear that their position will be turned over. And that's why we have, you know, this national security state, and it's because they know that if enough people get together and say, right, we're not getting involved anymore, we're not doing it anymore, but then their position is untenable.
Yeah,
nobody to rule over.
And if it looks as if that might start happening, they'll just start doing more divide and rules type crazy stuff.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that if you know that that's what they do and you're aware. So I'm saying you need to spread information about how the ruling class operates. So that's, divide and rule. And it's the tools they use to disrupt and stop the event that they fear the most, which is, what you call a popular uprising, to remove them from the position of power, which was, that's what they fear the most. And that's why they watch us at every move, that's why they divide us, that's why they do everything that they do to prevent that from happening. So it seems to me that if people become aware of how they operate, the tools that they use, the tactics that they use, the sort of people they are, how they're educated, so they're vast majority of them are taken away from their parents at an early age, and that's like a huge psychological shock, and that produces enough individuals who have their emotions separated from their rationality enough, which is a very unnatural state to be in as a human being, that allows them to be what they call leaders. They're able to take the hard decisions, to start a war, or for example, knowing full well that a million people might die, they can just say, start the war. I mean, what sort of humans does it take to be able to do that? And I think their socialisation and the way that they're brought up and educated is key to that, to the success of that. And it's that kind of information that people need to know about, I think. Who the ruling class are, how they operate, etc., etc., and just have the information so that you know that they use divide and rule a lot, and you know that they use the intelligence services to disrupt and all the rest of it. Blah, blah, fucking blah.
So do you think they're like kind of manufacturing psychopaths?
I think that's part of the design of public school education in this country. But I mean, it's in every culture where there's a ruling class, is that kind of separation. I think that is crucial to it. Separation from your parents is key to it. Yeah, and it won't produce, you know, all psych, you know, not all of them will be psychopaths, but they there'll be enough there to stick in the Foreign Commonwealth Office to pull the plug on some fucking economy, you know, like Zimbabwe, just pull the plugs on it. Fuck them, they're not playing the game, not playing our global capitalist game, so just let them suffer, you know.
Cheers. That corporate media is irrelevant to working people in this country, 90% of us who work for a living, and to democracy. It has become irrelevant. They want to treat us like we're mushrooms. They want to raise us in the dark and feed us a lot of manure. That's how they raise mushrooms.
Have you ever wondered why rich people never seem to be doing much? Yet are always making tons of money? Tons of money? While the rest of us have to work our entire lives, seems to get ahead. Well, that's because the rich are fucking crooks.
Fucking crooks. Greedy bastard. Greed. greedy bastards keep getting caught breaking their own rules.
28 counts of conspiracy, fraud, and insider trading, guilty on all counts.
A financial officer were convicted of taking more than $100 million in bonuses.
The former NASDAQ chief allegedly confessed that his investment business was a fraud.
16 felony charges, 19 in all, including conspiracy, wire fraud, extortion.
The former Senate leader exploited his powerful position to enrich himself.
Thanks for listening to the first show of Sheffield Indie Radio. Check back for future episodes on sheffield.indiemedia.org.uk.
Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.